I'm Helen Sharman, and you're listening to Stars Over Surrey on Brooklands Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm currently at Broadwater School, south of Guildford, for a special space-related day known as Get Space, and this is the fourth of consecutive of these events. Get Space is run by SpaceLink, an organisation set up to promote an interest in spaceflight and related areas. It's aimed at school children, and it's for schools from all over Surrey. I'm here, together with a colleague from Guildford Astronomical Society, and we're showing the children the surface and atmosphere of the sun through very specially constructed and heavily filtered telescopes, so it's quite safe. As fun as this might be for the children, the highlight of the day for the youngsters is definitely going to be meeting Helen Sharman, OBE, Britain's first astronaut. She spent 8 days in space in 1991, most of those aboard the Russian Mir space station. Helen has very kindly agreed to a short interview with me for Brooklands Radio and Stars Over Surrey. Helen, I'm delighted to meet you, and thank you very much indeed for this opportunity to talk to you. You are, of course, a patron of SpaceLink Learning Foundation, and you've supported this for several years since it started, I believe, and you're clearly very interested in keeping it going. We clearly have a common interest there in promoting an interest in spaceflight and astronomy amongst school children. So what is it that excites you about days such as this and an organisation such as SpaceLink?
I think anything that really gets across to people, particularly young people, the excitement, actually, although we're talking about space, for me, it's actually what's behind that. So I think I've always thought of space as being, yes, of course, it's an amazing opportunity, and isn't it exciting to consider our place in the universe, the mysteriousness of the whole thing, the beauty of everything. But actually, in order to study it, we need that science. And I think what I like very much about these kind of days is that I think young people pick up on bits of science that they might not otherwise do because they just love the interest of space.
Absolutely, absolutely. And although, you know, we focus on the astronauts who are the pinnacle of getting into space, but behind those astronauts there's an army of scientists, of technicians and engineers, all sorts of career possibilities for youngsters to be thinking about. So are there any special areas that you like to interest youngsters in? I know your own background, of course, is chemistry, but there's all sorts. There's life sciences, bioscience, geology, astronomy, all sorts of areas that are related.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, science, you can't really pocket it. I mean, we do still think of physics separate from chemistry, separate from biology, and that's often how it's taught. But actually, increasingly, science is becoming more of a one body again. And we have all sorts of different degree subjects now, and I think that is filtering back into school life as well. You know, you can't think about biology. You can't really understand it unless you understand chemistry. You can't really understand a lot of chemical processes unless you understand physics. To understand physics, you need maths, and actually the statistics comes right back to biology and living organisms, and so it is all in one, really. No one person can be to be the world expert at every aspect of science, because we now are so good at science, we know so much compared to a few hundred years ago, that actually we've had to specialise. But interestingly, even though we specialise, now those boundaries are getting very, very fuzzy. And I think that's the fun of it, you know. Science just describes the way we are, the way our world is, the way our universe is made up. And I think the less we imagine different pockets of it and the more we just open up to it, it's a way of understanding. And we're back to philosophy then, aren't we, really?
Fantastic. Thank you, Helen. You mentioned degree courses there. But, of course, not every child is cut out to go on degree courses. But I would still think that there's opportunity there for people who want to move into the direction of technicians, engineers, and maybe apprenticeship schemes to join those sorts of companies, like, for example, the Gaia space probe at the moment has got an incredibly sensitive chip on it. It's more sensitive than anything else that's been put into space for its measurement of parallax. And that was developed in the UK. And there must be loads and loads of technicians sitting behind there. And, you know, business encouraged apprenticeship schemes leading into those areas, then wonderful opportunities for children of today.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the right now, with the new sort of emphasis on apprenticeships for science technicians, and apprenticeships have never died in this country. We've always had them, but they've tended to be what I call very practical kind of applications. So you might become a machine tooler, so you can you know how to work a lathe and other machine tools very, very well, and you can make tiny metal parts high precision. You might be an apprentice bricklayer, but they've tended to be quite practical applications. Whereas now, I think what we're starting to understand is that actually you could be a science technician. Mm. And of course, they've always existed in schools and in universities to support a lot of the research and teaching that goes on. But nonetheless, to be able to actually to have a career as a technician rather than have to go through the university route. And I think actually very many able people will also choose the apprenticeship route, especially those people who prefer to think about their science being much more applied, like getting stuck straight in, you know?
Oh, it's great to see the enthusiasm there for what might happen in the future and how to get youngsters involved. Does SpaceLink get involved with local education authorities in trying to promote the spaceflight and related sciences or with businesses? I know we've got several here, like SSTL, for example. Is there areas that SpaceLink would like to move into, do you think?
Well, SpaceLink's always been set up to make science interesting through use of space resources. And we have a number of teachers' lesson plans to enable teachers who would not otherwise feel able to talk about space, even though they know it's interesting. They just somehow need the resources. They need the material. They need some facts. Teachers have got all sorts of stuff they have to do, particularly these days, I think, and life can be quite hectic for them. So anything that makes it a bit easier for them to talk about space. So that's where SpaceLink is, I think, is particularly useful. And these lesson plans are available through ESRO, the European Space Agency's regional office based in York, actually, in the UK. But in other places as well, through SpaceLink. And we also have like online clubs, information resources for students to go get directly from SpaceLink virtually. And it's days like today where sort of few and far between. We just do it once a year, but where we actually gather students together and provide things like your activity, which is really super. And I think however much you do that's, let's call it virtual, and however much information is there, and students, of course, find it very easy to access, it's still really great for them to get their hands on something. Yes. And to actually see with their own eyes something. Yes. Actually happening.
What I enjoy is hearing all the wows when they look through. I wonder if I may ask you about your own mission, going back a little while, because I came to see you do your talk at the H.G. Wells Centre in Woking. And one of the things I particularly remember you saying about the difficulties that you hadn't really quite expected was the noise level once you were aboard Mir. So what was it that caused that noise level, and how did you deal with it?
I think that was one of the things that, although I knew it was going to be, there was a noise level was going to be there, it was something like 70 decibels, something like that, so it's quite loud. I mean, you shout to make each other heard over that kind of noise. And you know what it's like when you turn off your computer at the end of the day and suddenly, ha, and it's the fan that has actually been keeping the computer cool that actually creates the noise. And we had a huge number of fans on board the space station because we needed those fans to circulate the air. And that's not just because it was quite warm and it's nice to have a fan on a hot day. The air doesn't normally circulate on board a space station unless you make it move, because convection, warm air rises because a bit of warm air weighs less than the same volume of cold air. But if the air is weightless, warm air weighs the same as cold air. It's the same density, so it doesn't necessarily rise. So you don't get convection currents on an orbiting space station. Though, yeah, so if you yourself are moving through the air, that's fine. Not only do you then create a bit of circulation, but you're always in, if you like, a bit of fresh air. But if you do nothing about it and you stay still as you breathe out all of this nice warm air, which naturally would rise on Earth, but it doesn't in space. And gradually you sort of end up breathing back in the air that you've breathed out, and the carbon dioxide concentration rises and rises. Yes. So actually you suffocate in your own breath if you don't circulate the air. So the fans are really vital. In fact, if it goes quiet in space, then you're worried, because you need to make sure you've got the fresh air. So yes, so different fans, and fans have to circulate the air through these long thin modules. Yes. So yes, so they can create quite a noise.
So were earplugs provided, or did you just have to grin and bear it?
We didn't actually have earplugs. In fact, if you do have earplugs, then it means that the alarms are less audible. So yes, an interesting sort of state of affairs. So it's not awful, the noise, it's just a bit tiresome. Astronauts' hearing does diminish a bit, and one of my jobs really was to monitor our hearing levels, and especially those that have been up there for quite a while. The astronauts' families, when they get back to Earth, complain because they want the TV turned on too loudly. But yeah, so it can be a problem. In fact, we're trying desperately to diminish the noise of these fans now, so International Space Station is improved. I understand from Tim Peake, actually, that it's not too bad. It's still in the low 60s decibels, but different modules actually have different volumes of background noise. And Tim told me that the Japanese module is the quietest. Isn't that lovely?
So I'm sure they all want to go and do their sleeping over that side. Oh, interesting. Thank you. Of course, one thing that you share with Tim Peake is that you both went up on the Soyuz rocket, which is a fantastic workhorse, and it's been in use for decades, and it's still going, it's steady, it's safe, and also, of course, the Soyuz module itself. Tim's was a TM, wasn't it, so a little bit upgraded, but that's been going for such a long time. Do you happen to know whether the Russians are, Roscosmos, are trying to develop anything new? We know, of course, NASA are developing their Orion craft and so on, and SpaceX are doing their crewed Dragon. Is there anything new that's thought of from the Russian side that you've heard about?
Well, all the novelty has really been from other countries, I would say, more from Europe and more from America, from NASA. So you alluded to the different sort of variations. The Russians have flown different variations. I think Tim's was a TMA something or other, actually. Mine was a TM. So yes, Soyuz started off as a plain old Soyuz. Yes. So it's gone through small incremental changes, but you know, it's nothing like we would say novel, not really innovative. Now, in some respects, this is quite good, because the Soyuz, you said it was very safe, it's a good workhorse. And in fact, I would much rather go on Soyuz than on anything else, because it's tried and tested, not particularly comfortable, but, you know, ho-hum, I'd rather be safe. And yeah, it works well. But we do really need something else. I mean, we're relying on this very old-fashioned chemical propulsion. If we can get something that is, let's say, makes it perhaps an easier ride, something where you're not sitting on top of all of these tons of basically flammable combustible materials, it would be so much better. And that's, I think, what we really need to be doing now. And of course, electric propulsion has been actually for quite some time being researched. We are already using electric propulsion on satellites once they've actually got what we call into space, so out of sort of the clutches of Earth's gravity. We're still relying on chemical propulsion. We need that impulse to get us up there. So that's where the real innovation comes. If anybody is really thinking hard, I think there's money to be made if you can develop a really high impulse engine that's not relying on chemicals.
Well, you never know. Some of the children that have been here today might find themselves working on it, or even propelled by it at some time in the future. Helen, it's been a delight talking to you. Thank you so much indeed for giving up some of your time for Brooklyn's Radio. But I think we've both got our duties to get back to. I need to get back to my telescopes, and I'm sure there's lots of children waiting to talk to you. So, Helen, thank you very much again.
My pleasure.
Well, that was something. My very first interview, and with a real live astronaut. It was really good to meet her, and she was very kind in agreeing to do this interview for us.